Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, why does the opposition Economic Freedom Fighters Party want to reopen a case to impeach President Cyril Ramaphosa over a foreign currency scandal in South Africa?
Every president must be accountable. We did the same thing with Jacob Zuma. When he spent money on Uganda, we took him to Constitutional Court and they said he must pay back the money. The same thing has happened to Ramaphosa because we are all the subjects of the Constitution.
And in the Democratic Republic of Congo, warnings that an attempt to change a constitution created in the aftermath of the brutal civil war will lead to serious instability. Will President Tshisekedi press ahead anyway? It's Wednesday, the 27th of November. First, we go to Nigeria. We are once again reporting on an attack by the Islamic State Group's West Africa Province branch that has killed soldiers in northeastern Nigeria. The insurgent group, ISWAP is its name for short, says it has killed and injured around 30 soldiers in an attack on a military facility in Borno State. The group also made a rare admission that it had lost some of its own fighters in clashes with the Nigerian military. The attack, confirmed by the military, happened a few days ago. But details are only just emerging. Official figures say the army killed 12 militants and lost 3 soldiers in the fighting. These figures differ significantly from those provided by the militants. But this latest attack gives us an opportunity to understand why the army is still battling these insurgencies several years on from claims that it had defeated them. Chris Ewoko is in Abuja for the BBC and he's been following developments.
This attack, as we understand, happened some days ago, precisely last week, but the information didn't really get out. The Islamist group, now known as IS West Africa Province Branch, that is ISWAP, invaded a military facility in northeast Nigeria. The report was that some soldiers were killed. Information from military sources indicated that several soldiers were killed, but the Nigerian Defense Headquarters later came out after some time to confirm that indeed there was an attack. It was a surprise attack which was carried out, according to the Nigerian Defense Headquarters, by unconfirmed number of jihadist group, and 5 soldiers were killed, according to the Defense Headquarters, while 10 other soldiers were injured. They didn't give much details, apart from the fact that the group targeted troops that were deployed at a stabilization operation, Proforce and Defense site in Gubbio local government area of Borno State in northeast Nigeria.
Right. So the Islamic State group is claiming that they killed and injured around 30 soldiers, which differs from the Nigerian government's point of view. But they also did acknowledge that they themselves have lost members. And apparently that's quite an unusual thing for them to do. But you said that it was a surprise attack. Why is the Nigerian military still surprised by attacks like these?
Well, that's the question that everybody here in Nigeria is still asking. In fact, the other question is, why are there this kind of attacks still taking place in the Northeast, especially at a time that the government said it's degraded Boko Haram and other extremist group operating in the area? At the moment, it now seems that these attacks are sort of pandering to people's views that, despite the claims that the security agencies are on top of the situation in the Northeast, operations of jihadi groups like the ISWAP and Boko Haram factions are still very active in the area. And it's also pushed this narrative that right now the Nigerian security forces appear to be overwhelmed, especially because they are also faced with other banditry in the northwest of the country, as well as a new group that has just emerged in Sokoto State in the northwest that is called Blaku Rawas. They are also faced with separatist agitations, activities in the southeast part of Nigeria. And all these, many people think, would stretch even any country's military personnel and make them ineffective.
And you did say that this attack, the one that we're reporting on now, took place last week, but details are only emerging now. Why does it take so long for information to emerge about these attacks?
Yeah, so there are two reasons why these information don't get out on time. One, the Nigerian military wants to cover up whatever is happening so that the public don't get to know about it. That's the major reason that sometimes when it happens, they don't issue any statement. So the media and the public struggle to get the information from eyewitnesses and people who are close to the area. And this takes some time, probably a day or two or even more. Some can even take up to a week. The other reason is that right now, with attack on telecommunication infrastructure and the power lines in the part of the country, it's difficult to get information out quickly via telephone. So people who come with this information are probably travelers who have witnessed what happened, and they move from the location down to Maiduguri where there are opportunities to make phone calls.
Now, just tell us a little bit about the IS group acknowledging that some of its fighters were killed in these clashes. It is an unusual move, right?
Indeed, it's actually a very rare act for the Islamic State group to acknowledge that they lost members of their group in a fight. But that is also to indicate, because the Nigerian army did say that it killed 12 members of the militant group, even though another report indicated that more than 50 members of the group were killed. At the moment, it's hard to say because the IS group did not state the number of their members that were killed, even though the Nigerian army mentioned 12. But there are indications that there was a heavy fight between the Nigerian army soldiers as well as the IS group. And indeed, both parties lost personnel that they may not want the exact number to be known by the public.
But I understand that IS never or very rarely acknowledges that they've lost personnel. Is it because they lost so many in this case or what? And why don't they acknowledge?
Exactly what a lot of people are thinking here, that it's possible that they lost a number of their members and they could not cover it because the number is big. Again, many people are also suggesting that it could be a new twist in their mode of communication operations, where they may want to now become a little bit more transparent with the information they are also giving to the public. Don't forget that although they are Islamist group, they have their own channel. And when they give out information, they want the public to trust such information. Probably the other reason why they are coming out in a kind of transparent way to make their stories now believable by the public.
And how did they make this information available?
Well, they do have an agency which, of course, broadcast their information that news outlets and other organizations monitor to obtain some information about their activities.
Okay. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you very much, Audrey.
Thank you, Chris. Long time no hear. Nice to talk to you again.
Yes.
All right. Then.
Yeah.
Ciao.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's Chris Ewoko in Abuja for the BBC. In South Africa, the Constitutional Court is hearing an interesting case. It involves the President, Cyril Ramaphosa, and the decision by the last parliament not to begin impeachment hearings against him. Now, as you know, impeachment is a formal statement by a legislative or legally constituted body that a person in high office has committed a serious offence, and it is the beginning of the process of charging them. Anyway, 2 years ago, South Africa's parliament began hearing a case that President Ramaphosa was guilty of a serious offence involving the sale of buffalo and a large amount of foreign cash stashed in sofas around his private home. Parliament at the time was dominated by the president's party, the African National Congress, and it refused to debate a report into Mr. Ramaphosa's conduct. Now, the Economic Freedom Fighters, a party that has a voluble presence in South Africa's parliament, has brought the matter back to the highest court in the land.
Every president must be held responsible. Every president must be accountable. We did the same thing with Jacob Zuma when he spent money on Gandla We took him to constitutional court and they said he must pay back the money. The same thing must happen to Ramaphosa, because we are all the subjects of the constitution. No one is above the constitution. So we are here to hold the executive accountable.
The issues are dense but interesting, because it gives us a chance to see how democratic institutions function under fire. The ANC has lost its dominance in politics, and this case gives us a glimpse into the new realities. But we are first going to spool back to the events that brought us here with Ongama Mthimkha, who is a political analyst and acting director at the Raymond Mhlaba Center for Governance and Leadership at the Nelson Mandela University in Gqeberha, on South Africa's southeast coast. Okay, so let's do very, very broad strokes. Pala-pala, sure. Or Farmgate, as it's called. And the first impeachment attempt. Just tell us, firstly, what the scandal is about.
So President Cyril Ramaphosa, sometime in 2020, suffered a break-in in his house. The thieves took away with dollars that were hidden in sofas, among other things. And this was not reported, and it is alleged that his security detail engaged in illegal activities in order to investigate the matter. It surfaced in the South African public domain when former spy boss Arthur Fraser opened a case against the president and his security detail, alleging that they had engaged in these illegal activities, but not quite being forthright in terms of what crime he was leveling against the president, because the president had been a victim of that crime. What became a scandal was the idea that the president had kept foreign currency in one of his properties, and it's debated between $660,000 to $4 million, with the official word from the president being, you know, 600 some odd US dollars. Now, it became a big issue because there were allegations that these funds were proceeds of some illicit activities, something that the president denied, said this was a result of a sale of buffaloes, as the president is a game farmer. But long story short is that the scandal resulted in the Parliament of the Republic of South Africa commissioning a high-level panel constituted by a former judge in order to establish whether the president had a case to answer based on the prima facie evidence that was there. That panel made a conclusion that the president had a prima facie case to answer. The ANC in parliament, they voted against the instituting of impeachment proceedings against the president. And it looks like from the proceeding at the Constitutional Court that the position of the ANC is going to be withheld, because the opinion of the Constitutional Court justices that were cross-examining the lawyers of the opposition seem to suggest that they do not hold that high-level panel report in good light, because there's a debate, for example, about how the panel failed to establish whether there was sufficient evidence for an impeachment case, which the Constitutional Court argues should have been the test, given the fact that this lands itself on issues of criminality and the general test there for conviction is beyond reasonable doubt.
So just for clarity, tell us, why was the decision made not to proceed with the impeachment process against the president at that time?
At the time, the ANC was going to its conference, and this decision was made somewhere around November, December in 2022 by parliament on the eve of the ANC conference, in which President Cyril Ramaphosa was up against former AU Commission Chair Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma. So it was not in the best interest of the ANC as the governing party to be handling, or in fact the dominant faction in the ANC at the time, to be handling a state-level crisis in parliament while going to that conference. There couldn't be any decision made outside of what the ANC felt at the time. So while the speaker of the ANC had instituted the high-level panel, it was the ANC as a majority in parliament at the time that refused to accept that that panel's report should form part of an impeachment process. So the ANC blocked the impeachment process. They are arguing that the case that is brought by the economic freedom fighters is premised on a report that is flawed, which report fails to establish whether the president has a criminal case to answer. And the argument is that for determining whether there's a criminal case to answer, you need sufficient evidence, not prima facie a case, as you would on a case that doesn't require proof beyond reasonable doubt.
So who does that help? Because I'm really trying to understand the value of it.
It doesn't aid the opposition in holding the president accountable in the same manner that they felt it does because of the stature of the chairperson of that committee being a retired former chief justice. But what we're hearing from the Concord justice is that, in fact, that's a flawed assumption, which then leaves us in the interim with the political issue, which has already been settled as per the argument that was advanced by the justice, to say there's a political process and then there's the criminal allegations against the president. For that, you need other institutions that are investigating the president to establish whether there were criminal acts that were undertaken. Among those institutions have been the Reserve Bank of South Africa. There was also the South African Revenue Service, as far as taxation aspects are concerned. Their report, too, didn't find anything against the president. And so what we are left with is the criminal case that is with the Hawks. But that has not reached a level where the National Prosecuting Authority could make a decision to say they're going to charge the president. So we are left with a situation in which Palapala, as things stand, is a mute scandal that cannot aid the South African opposition, at least in terms of its legal weighting. Politically, a scandal of this nature is the kind of scandal that should immediately culminate in a political falling on one's sword, okay, by the president. But what's happened in both the ANC politics and the politics of the country has been the lowering of the bar to say, unless one has been proven guilty in a court of law or charged criminally, then they fall on their sword. The constitution of the ANC does actually say that if you bring the organization into disrepute, and it lists, among other things, questions of integrity, questions of misconduct. But in giving effect to that rule, both the ANC and, in this case, Parliament, have failed to simply use broad repute issues and sought to rely on legal standards, which are way higher or lower for political office, in my view, depending on how you are looking at it.
Right. So they're not taking the moral view that you are disappointing
exactly.
people, you're bringing your party into disrepute, and you are not acting in a manner befitting of the president of the country or a leader in the ANC or the country. So what I want to know is, why did they do it? What political point are they trying to make? Are they acting in the public interest, or are they acting in the interest of their parties?
There was an alignment of interest between what is in the public interest and what is opposition party interest. It appears as though the benefit to them at this stage is going to be clarity about the true stature and the true standing of that report. And once they get that clarity, it helps them to refocus their energies on where they can get the most political and legal outcome to act against the president.
So it's a case of case building in the interest of building South Africa's institutions, or in the interest of bringing down President Ramaphosa? Julius Malema, specifically of the EFF, he has kind of vowed that he would bring about the downfall of the president.
If you're a politician, there's always going to be somebody that is paying for your blood, not in a literal sense. So that's a given. Throughout the period in which we were under a dominant party, to approach the courts of the land in order to enforce particular political outcomes when there is a legal aspect to those outcomes has always been in the best interest of South Africans, because we are a constitutional democracy. And whenever our constitution is protected, even if it's by politicians acting out of their own self-interest, it is a good thing for the nature of democracy that South Africa has, because our courts have been proven over and over that they are very impartial. Politically, the EFF gained good mileage from this because they are facing internal strife that has been a source of bad publicity for them. So from this, they come across as the ultimate opposition party. But I suspect that after today, theirs is going to be framed as a witch hunt against the president when the Constitutional Court makes a finding that the report that they are relying on is not a report, that its contents or its findings are not sufficient for a case that has got allegations of criminality in it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you.
And that was Ongama Mthimka, political analyst and acting director at the Raymond Mhlaba Center for Governance and Leadership at the Nelson Mandela University. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Should the constitution of the Democratic Republic of Congo be changed? It depends on who answers that question. President Felix Tshisekedi says yes. His predecessor, Joseph Kabila, first said yes when he was president. And now that he's not, he says no. Interesting. They both said at one time or the other that the 2006 constitution, drawn up in the aftermath of a vicious war, was not good enough. And in any case, it had been drawn up by people in foreign countries. They've also both sung the praises of the same constitution when it suited them. I should tell you that civil society groups and the powerful Catholic Church says it should not be changed, and warn that any attempt to do so will lead to violence, something the people of the DRC have had enough of, even as they continue to suffer it, especially in the mineral-rich east of the country. So why is President Tshisekedi determined to press ahead with a national commission to draft a new constitution? Richard Moncrief is Great Lakes Project Director for the International Crisis Group. Let's talk about President Tshisekedi's reasons for wanting to change the constitution. What is he saying, why he wants to do it?
He says that the current constitution is not adapted to current reality. He says that the constitution blocks institutions, and he pointed to the fact that it took 5 or 6 months to form a government earlier this year. And he says it was written abroad, and it was written by fighters of the civil war. Now, all those things are little bits of reality picked to suit his case. But I don't think they satisfy everybody.
Especially since he had endorsed this very same constitution. He actually was quite happy with the fact that it had been written outside of the country, or with the participation of people from outside the country, right?
Now, of course, it was written abroad because the country was in a state of civil war, and the constitution was written, as is often the case, as part of a peace agreement. But it was written by very high-ranking and credible and prestigious Congolese constitutional lawyers and so forth. And obviously, the president can't ignore that. And as you say, he's previously spoken out in favor of the constitution. People are also asking themselves, well, why hasn't he talked about this in the previous 4 years? So the timing is very strange. And a lot of the reactions from opposition and civil society in DR Congo do focus on this question of timing. Why do this now? Why bring this question up now?
So why indeed now?
Well, what the opposition and church say, and I think have a very strong case, is that this is not a national priority. There's a war going on in the east of the country. The social picture looks very bad: hunger, displacement, very bad situation with public services and so forth. And suddenly the government and the president start talking about changing the constitution. Now, the great risk of this, of course, is that the next 3 years all the political energy of Kinshasa will be consumed with this question. We're already seeing this happen. So why are they raising it now? Well, I think we have to take very seriously the suspicions that this is simply an attempt to unlock the prohibition on President Tshisekedi standing for another term in 3 years' time when there are new elections, new presidential elections slated in the country. And that's what really worries people. Of course, we've seen this happen before because his predecessor, President Joseph Kabila, he also wanted to change the constitution and he didn't manage to do so. But what he did do is delay elections for 2 years to try to give himself time to change the constitution. In the end, he failed to do so because there was a strong resistance coming from Congolese civil society, notably the church, and also from some neighbours, notably Angola, which is a very powerful country in the Great Lakes and in Central Africa. So he didn't manage to that time, but it looks like President Tshisekedi is going to try the same route.
Interesting that President Kabila is rejecting what President Tshisekedi is saying now about why he wants to change the constitution, when in fact he had tried to do so earlier as well, as you just pointed out. But let's talk about this 2006 constitution. President Tshisekedi had said that it had been written by compatriots representing the diversity of the Congolese nation. Tell us about that constitution and why it's been a political football for both former President Kabila and now for President Tshisekedi.
Well, I have to say first, the constitution isn't really a problem. It's functioned reasonably well. And the political problems that the Congo has suffered from since 2006 are not really related to the constitution per se. The reason there's a big focus on the constitution is that following the civil war, there was a fairly broadly held understanding that one of the reasons that DR Congo descended into war was essentially tyranny, an authoritarian government, in this case exercised by President Mobutu, of course. And one of the things that people in the Congo, the conclusions they came to, is that one way to avoid authoritarian government and eventually tyranny is to place in the constitution a provision that the president can only serve 2 terms and must then leave. We know that, like many other African countries, it is a very centralized system with a huge amount of resources passing through the president's office. And this means, of course, that the temptation to want to stay in power is very strong. And so those who wrote the constitution were aware of this. And so they wrote in a clause which says not only that the president cannot serve more than 2 terms, but there's another clause saying that this clause concerning term limits cannot be changed. So there's a double lock within the constitution, making it especially hard to change a constitution. And there actually is, interestingly, a current debate stimulated by people in Tshisekedi's party about not just changing it, but completely renewing it and having a completely new constitution and therefore what they call a new republic. And the fear is that that would allow Tshisekedi to simply reset the clock and start again and therefore remain in power.
So how does President Tshisekedi propose to move forward with this? What is his plan?
I think the first thing to underline is that he has a big majority in parliament following the elections in December, but that majority is very fragmented. So his party, which does not in itself have a majority, has been very agitating for change of the constitution, very much lining up behind the president, all kind of flying flags, pushing the boat out as far as they can and so forth, and playing the president's game. But other very powerful members of his coalition have said nothing. Why? Well, partly because they're ambitious people. They're a similar age to Tshisekedi or even older. And they also want to be president. That's also part of their political ambitions. So evidently, this doesn't serve their longer-term purpose. And the unity of Tshisekedi's coalition could certainly be severely tested by this. The second point to make is that it is very unlikely to be popular with the population, making the route of a referendum very difficult for Tshisekedi. Now, the other route which can lead to a change of constitution is to get a large qualified majority of votes in the Congress of the lower and upper houses of parliament. Again, that looks very difficult. But what we do see is Tshisekedi and his party trying to prepare the ground, trying to form an argument, trying to push their pieces where they can and take opportunistic initiatives. They're also at some point going to have to test the international waters. And I think that's an interesting angle. We know that international opposition, and as I mentioned, in particular, the opposition of some key neighbours such as Angola, was very important in 2016 to 18. Is the context the same? Well, that's yet to be tested. International powers didn't speak out about some of the deficiencies of the December 2023 elections, possibly, arguably, leaving them in something of a weak position to now stand up and talk about the possible revision of the constitution. And of course, remember that Tshisekedi is very unlikely to stand up and say, I want to change the constitution in order to stay in power. He'll just keep flying flags about the constitution, but it will be difficult for international diplomats to speak against that because he won't be clear about his intentions likely until we're much closer to the critical time in 2 or 3 years' time.
That's Richard Moncrief with the International Crisis Group as Project Director for the Great Lakes. Focus on Africa was put together by Rob Wilson, Nyasha Michelle, and Sunita Nahar in London. Frenny Joey was based in Nairobi. Paul Bajibinga was the senior producer. Chris Kuzaris was our technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. Before I go, a reminder that our sister pod, Africa Daily, will take a closer look at the use of Uganda's military courts to try civilians following opposition politician Dr. Kizza Besigye appearing in one such court. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.